married my wife, we followed the traditional thing here in America that you don't see the bride the day of the wedding. So we made our wedding in the morning because I didn't know if I could wait all the way until afternoon or evening. 10 o'clock in the morning, we had a wedding. Everyone said, what are you doing? 10 o'clock in the morning? That's not a normal time. No, it wasn't normal. But we wanted to get married. And I remember watching her walk down that aisle thinking, can this possibly be true? Can this possibly be true? Nothing else mattered that day. I wasn't looking at anyone else. I didn't pay attention to anyone else. It was all her. There are other times when I have found myself waiting with huge expectation. One of them was when I was a young boy in Africa. I was born right in the middle, and I grew up in the West, and then we went to the East, to Uganda, to work when I was an adult. But when I was a boy growing up, I was sent off to boarding school, and we would spend 3 months at boarding school, and then my parents would come and pick us up for 1 month, and that's how it went. 3 months away, 1 month at home, 3 months away, 1 month at home. I went away to boarding school when I was 7 years old, and I really, really struggled being away from my family. I had siblings there, I had two brothers and one sister who was there, but it was not like having parents there. And I was the youngest of those four children, so they didn't want me around. You know, I was just too young to be with them. They were too cool for me. So when it came time for my parents to come back and pick me up, I could not wait. I remember walking out past our soccer field, our football pitch at the school. We had these big cement pillars where they had intended to put up a gate to enter the school. They never put up the gate, but these two big huge pillars were sitting out there. And I would climb up and sit on top of one of those pillars. And I would just look down the road as far as I could, waiting for my dad's car to come over that hill. It was about a kilometer down the road that I could see there was a crest, and I would wait. And every time I saw a vehicle crest that hill, I was just hoping it was my parents. There were times when I sat out there on that cement pillar for an awful long time. I would think it was an hour or two. I don't know. We didn't have phones. We didn't have any way of letting... My parents had no way to let me know when they would be here. But that was all I could think of. But let me put it in a different setting. What about when people are attacking us? When people are saying things about us that aren't true? When life is really difficult? Then who is it that we're looking for to come help us? It was about... Not too long ago, I was in a place where people were attacking me. And I could not, I had no idea how this was coming. It came totally out of the blue. They were saying things about me that I had never heard anybody say about me before. And I'll tell you, the first place I wanted to run was to a few friends of mine who I thought might have some influence on these people to get them to stop. But the Lord stopped me. He said, that's not where you're running. There's a better place to go. I'd like us to open our Bibles tonight to Psalm 62. Psalm 62, God poured into my life a few years ago, and I absolutely love to be reminded by the Holy Spirit of where to go when I need to get my mind off of everyone and everything else. Verse 1 starts this way, Psalm 62. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. Now, as David writes this psalm, someone is trying to attack him. We're not sure who. It is very possible it's when his oldest son, Absalom, tried to take his throne. And he succeeded for a while. David had to leave Jerusalem. And as he he's leaving, people are laughing at him, people are ridiculing him, people are saying horrible things about him, because Absalom, after all, is far younger, obviously. He's far better looking than David, and he's really, really popular. David says, "For God alone my soul waits." You go down to verse 5, and he says it again, "For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence." Where do you go when you need help? Something that the culture here in the United States does not teach us and does not nurture in us. Maybe for some of you, you learned this somewhere else. But here in the United States, we do not learn much about being silent. But we find it really hard to be silent, don't we? I go into people's homes, and I'm amazed sometimes. The TV is on, and I can sit in their home for 30 minutes with them, and they never turn it off. You know, see, the TV is talking in the corner, and we're trying to have a conversation, and you can't even communicate. We don't know what to do with silence. Many of us walk into our houses, and we tell Alexa to turn on music, because, you know, you just can't have it be quiet. We get in the car, and I'm one who does this. I turn on the news, and I listen to the news when I'm driving. And once in a while, I try to turn it off, and it's hard. It's hard to just have it be silent. David found that his soul being silent before the sole God of the universe is where he found strength, and where he found safety. So I'm going to challenge you tonight as we look through this psalm to ask yourself, do I know how to be silent? And if so, it's not just to be silent and do nothing, and it's not to be silent and empty my mind. It's to be silent in the presence of God and to focus on him so that I see nothing else, I hear no one else. All I want is him. That takes a lot of discipline. It's not something that we are used to doing. But soul silence before the soul, the only God, is where we will find complete safety. And it's where we'll find all the strength we need. We see it in David's life. For God alone, my soul waits. He uses a little word, alone, 6 times. It's a little tiny word in the Hebrew that he wrote. It's ach. And he says, for God, ach. God only. He's the only one. No one else, nothing else matters. Now, where could David have turned? He could have turned to Joab, his commander of the army. He could have turned to his huge army. He couldn't have turned to his 30 mighty men, who were like the Secret Service, his personal bodyguard. David could have turned to many people, but in this time of trial, it's to God only. Nowhere else that my soul waits. If you take out making this flow in English, this is how David wrote it. Only to God silence my soul. I love that. Only to God silence my soul. No eloquence in the world is half so meaningful as the patient silence of a child of God waiting on his father. It's the most beautiful thing ever found. And yet we have lost, I think, the ability to do it. So what does silence mean? Is David talking about just not talking and just not making noise? What does silence mean? That David is talking about being quiet, but being restful in that quietness. Not anxious, not worried, not concerned, just restful. In fact, being motionless. Just completely trusting somebody else. When is the last time you have been completely silent, completely restful, trusting God with everything that's coming down on you? challenges at work, challenges in relationships with friends, challenges maybe in your family. What does it mean to just be quiet and wait? My soul waits in silence. That little word wait is not actually there in the Hebrew, but it's understood. David is saying, I am reaching out to you and anticipating an answer. So what is waiting? Waiting is really just a prolonged hope. It's hope stretched out. Because we can hope in God. God is always faithful. So waiting is not resignation, saying, well, there's nothing I can do. I just hope God shows up. That's not waiting on God. David is hopeful. He is certain. He is confident. But he has to keep hoping and keep being certain and keep being confident. It's just hope stretched out. But the presence of God stills all of our activity when we're in his presence. So David says, for God alone, only him. What does he wait for? Well, he says everything comes from him. Verse 1, my salvation comes from him. He is my rock. He's my salvation. He's my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. David always refers to God as his rock. God was the place where he hid. He went to God when he needed a fortress. And we know that David hid in caves. And when I go to Israel, I love to look in some of the caves. We actually can find some of the caves where David probably hid. Because he talks about going to get water. And there are only a couple places where he could have gotten water. But David's real place of hiding was simply God. He piles one metaphor after another. He's my rock, and he's my salvation, he's my fortress, because he's only looking to God. But then, why do you think he says, I won't be greatly shaken? We would expect him to say, I won't be shaken at all, right? He says, I won't be greatly shaken. I love the fact that David is so real. Things can shake us, can't they? Unexpected things can really get us off kilter. When all of a sudden we hear that somebody's talking about us and saying things that aren't true, it can unnerve us. David says, I am shaken sometimes, but I'm not going to fall over. I'm not greatly shaken because I can trust in God. And then he does something very interesting in verse 3. In verse 3 and 4, he begins to look at his opposers. What's so important about that is that when David is being assailed by his enemies, whatever was going on right now, possibly Absalom, we don't know, but when David had enemies hot on his tail, he does not look at his enemies first. He looks at God. When you've got problems surrounding you, how much time do you spend looking at the problems versus just sitting in the presence of God and saying, you're enough. You're big enough. You're good enough. You're great enough. We have a tendency to look at the problems, don't we? We want to fix them. David looks at God first. Verses 1 and 2 is all about God. My soul, be silent before him. He's my fortress, he's my rock, he's my salvation, he's all I need. And then David can go and look at his oppressors. You see, David knew, long before Philippians was ever written, David knew what would be written in Philippians 4, verses 7, 6, 7, and 8. In Philippians 4, we're told, don't be anxious for anything, but in everything, through prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard and keep your hearts in Christ Jesus. So we are supposed to not be anxious, but simply present our issues where? Our issues to God. And then verse 8 says something very important of Philippians chapter 4. It says, this is what you're supposed to think about, brothers, whatever is true, honorable, just, pure, lovely, whatever is commendable, if there's something excellent, think on these things. God is true. God is pure. God is lovely. God is excellent. And so David begins by just looking to God. Then verses 3 and 4, he says, but I do have enemies. He's very realistic, and they are coming on a full frontal attack. Verse 3, how long will all of you attack a man to batter him? David specifically says, all of you, lots of you, verses 1. One guy, and there's a whole bunch of people coming against him. He says, you want to batter me? I'm like a leaning wall. I'm a tottering fence. I'm not strong in and of myself right now. They only plan, his enemies, to thrust him down from his high position. Now, David is a king, and so they want to take his throne away from him. We are children of God, and there will be people who will assail us. You find professors letting you know you're not much of anything here if you're a Christian. When I started my PhD in Scotland, in Edinburgh, the very first meeting I ever had with my professors, they said, are you really a Christian? I said, yes. You really believe that God exists somewhere? I said, yes. You really believe that there is something like truth? I said, yes. They said, you'll never make it here. You'll flunk out. Because you're not intelligent. We can tell right now you're not intelligent. That was my first conversation with my team of three guiding professors through my PhD. We're going to be assailed. We're going to be assailed, and people are going to try and pull us down. He feels his weakness. He feels like he's tottering. And then he says, they take pleasure in their falsehoods, and they bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. Mouths hurt, don't they? What people say about us, it really hurts. Maybe you don't experience that, but sometimes as a pastor, that's just part of the game. People don't like what you did. They don't like what you said. They don't like the position you took. And they start to talk. And we can say, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Well, words do hurt. They do hurt. But what does David do when he says, they will speak against me with their mouths? Then there's this little phrase, Selah. Think about it. Think about what? God first. I'm going to be silent before him. I'm going to trust him. I'm going to think about how pure and how great and how lovely and how kind he is. He's my rock. He's my fortress. He's my strength. And yeah, there's everybody else. But they don't compare to him. He's got his priorities right. And he writes that little word, Selah. Just stop and think about God first. And then all the enemies. And then verse 5 and 6, he says, this is where I find my strength. This is where I find my strength. He starts in verse 5 by saying what he said in verse 1 all over again. For God alone, my soul, wait in silence. There's one little difference. Do you see what the difference is? Look at verse 1 and look at verse 5. So just a little tiny difference. When you see a little tiny difference, there's a reason for it. Verse 1, for God alone, my soul waits in silence. Verse 5, for God alone will my soul wait in silence. In verse 1, he says, this is where I am. I'm just trusting you. In verse 5, he's reminding his soul, don't stop. He's telling his soul, wait. Trust him. Now, wait means hope. It means look forward. It's not resignation. Remember, it's looking forward. But he has to remind himself to look forward. Why does David do that? It gets hard when we're waiting for God and he's not answering on our timetable, doesn't it? You know, sometimes we say God always answers at the 11th hour. I think he answers at the 11th hour in the 59th minute a lot of times. I mean, it's just, you say, God, it's way past time. I'm waiting for you. You need to do something. And you still wait. That's where we grow strong. It's when we're waiting for him. And David reminds his heart. He says, oh, my soul, wait, and in silence. Don't try to fix it yourself. What is David saying? He's saying, the end of verse 5, my hope is in him. You see, David is not sitting back saying, there's nothing I can do. I'm just, God, if you don't intervene, I'm a mess. David is saying, I've got huge hope. I know who God is. He is great. He is powerful. I belong to him. I'm just waiting for the moment he's going to step in and change this. For the time he's going to defend me. David is looking forward with hope. Do you wait for God with hope? Or do you just wait for God with resignation? It's a real difference. Sometimes we pray and we say, God, I don't know what else to do but to pray. Well, that's exactly what we should be doing. We just pray and we say, I anticipate you to do something that is beyond anything I can imagine. I'm expecting you to step in and change the situation in a way that I can't imagine. I can think of several illustrations in my life where this happened, but one of the ones where I had to wait and wait and wait was when my oldest son was 12 years old. He was electrocuted extremely badly. His heart stopped beating. His jaws contracted and were closed, and he went into convulsions. And I knelt over him. I wanted to do CPR. I couldn't get his mouth open to do CPR. Put my hand on his chest, and his heart was just vibrating. It wasn't beating. It was just fluttering. I couldn't do anything. I prayed, oh God, please, please, please heal my son. Nothing happened. I tried again to slap his face. He couldn't respond. He was laying on his back on the ground by now, but his back was completely arched. He went totally gray. He was dying. And it had been a minute and a half. No breathing. No heart beating. I prayed again out loud, God, will you please start his heart? And all of a sudden he coughed. And his heart started. And I thought, God's healed him. God's healed him. And then I talked to a doctor, a British doctor. We were in Africa, and the British doctor said, no, he's in a bad way. When this happens, people don't live. And I called my father. He was here in Michigan, and he's a doctor. And I called my dad, and I said, Dad, what? He says, well, tell me what happened. And I explained, and I said he was reaching up, and he grabbed with his left hand, grabbed this pipe, and the pipe was electrified. He didn't know it. It was just a water pipe. And it went right through his body, right through the middle, and it came out both feet, three places on one leg and three places on the other leg. And my dad said, oh, that's bad. He says that means it went right through his heart, because it came through the left arm, went through all the organs in the middle of his trunk, and came out the bottom. And so now I gotta wait, right? I just gotta wait.